first a presentation by Lewis on the work that has been done in the entity-specific tasks of XBRL International. Then Anna will talk a little bit about the anchoring rules that are being put in place for the ESMA handling of entity-specific disclosures. And then I will just conclude with some kind of observations or about if there are any possible implications of this new guidelines and this study.
Thanks.
Lewis will start. Mm-hmm.
All right. So that covers your introductory slides, I guess. So we'll jump to the aims of today's. Aims of the entity-specific disclosure task force is not the same. All right, but let's start here. So first off, I want to acknowledge that one of the lead contributors to this effort is Andy over here. Everybody probably already knew that, but I would be remiss if I did not point that out. It also means that I might kick some questions over to Andy too.
Nice.
That's the way that works. You get acknowledgement, you get called on. So this task force was created a while ago with the recognition that with the recognition that elements were being, we always knew about extension elements. You know, they've been there for a long time. But at least some of us didn't recognize until a few years had passed that they were a problem in the respect that they were what we characterized as orphaned, meaning a user of the data had no way to understand what to do with them, and they just fell on the floor. And so that spawned this project that quickly started to focus on a couple of areas. So the primary focus of this group, after several meetings, was going to be on numeric entity-specific disclosures as opposed to text. And that's primarily because numerics were the thing that users cared about the most, because that's typically what they consume into their earnings models and other tabular information. And the text, the narratives, frankly, were a little bit more complicated, and we partitioned the work along those lines. We wanted to deal with the first pain point and then come back to the text at some later date. And so we wanted to go through and address the known concerns of the users. We also say in here in prepares, I have a strong bias here that the primary focus of this group was on the users of the data, but we took the prepares into account through our analysis. And then at the end of the day, we needed to make recommendations on how to move forward with this problem. And we have published about, two or three or 4 weeks ago now, Andy, the recommendations, and it's open for comment. It's on the XAI website, and it's open for comment through the end of May. And so we welcome your feedback. So moving on to the next slide. So let's talk a little bit about what an entity-specific disclosure is. So it's really important to draw a distinction here between what we're talking about in this document is entity-specific disclosure and what is commonly referred to as an extension or element extensions as opposed to extension taxonomies. And while the primary concern that we have is with extension elements, it's important to understand that depending on your reporting environment, an extension element can be handled in a variety of different ways. And in those reporting environments, you will always have entity-specific disclosures because they are a product of the reporting domain. So the simple example, and I also will qualify this by knowing that whether you're talking about GAAP or you're talking about IFRS or other reporting frameworks, people can interpret what is in any specific disclosure slightly differently. But the point is that something that the literature says disclose applies to all filers. It's a common thing, all payers, it's a common item. You know, you're required to disclose cash. But something that the literature would speak to in terms of from your business, tell us about your business, that's going to result in things that are entity specific because it's specifically about your business. It's not about all entities. The disclosure that I like to use as an example is the segment reporting, where you're specifically reporting operating segments that are specific to the entity. Those are entity-specific disclosures. You have an accounting standard that says disclose those segments, but that aspect of it is entity-specific. And so what we're trying to cover in this document is how do you deal with those entity-specific disclosures in different reporting scenarios? And you'll see as we go through this, there are two primary reporting scenarios. There's open reporting and there's closed reporting. And we'll talk about that on a later slide. Two things that are out of bounds here. Andy, and feel free to jump in at any point. Two areas that are out of bounds in our initial work here is taxonomy design or architectural requirements. First off, XBRL International has a separate group that deals with architectural issues, and really a slippery slope for us. We could have spent a lot of time trying to solve the architectural issues are coming up with architectural solutions to the problems, and that wasn't our primary charge. We wanted to focus on, you know, what is an entity-specific disclosure, how are entity-specific disclosures articulated in different scenarios, and then if we identify what we think are solutions, we can kick that over to other groups, which in fact we have. The filing rules is really down to the regulators. Again, a lot of our conversations did start taking us in that direction because discussions were, well, gee, if we did this or that we did that, we could constrain that. And all regulators, depending on, again, what their framework looks like, could have very different ways of handling what we were talking about, whether it's the SEC or it's ESMA or whoever. And so, again, that was a slippery slope, and we didn't want to go down that. We might address it in the future, but for the moment, that's out of scope. So the next slide, so this roughly just sketches out the activities of the group. So we started, and the slides that come after this go into more detail. But, you know, we did our environmental scan, if you will. We focused on what was out in the market. We talked to, I guess we had interviews with a half a dozen or so regulators. I say interviews. They actually presented to the group, and they talked about what they were currently doing within their reporting environment. We reviewed a lot of sample ESDs to identify patterns so we could, you know, come up with all of the different ways that we think an ESD could be expressed within an XBRL model. One of the key pieces of this was defining the actual business requirement for the entity-specific disclosures. Obviously, going into it, we had a rough idea of what we thought that was, but until we had a better understanding of what was happening in practice and we had a better understanding of the different patterns, our business requirements weren't really fully fleshed out. And, in fact, they changed. And then, of course, we wanted to the extent that we could make this work within our existing technical specifications, that would be ideal, right? Can we address these problems with what we have, or do we have to invent something new? Now, my bias is to use what we've got if we can, but if not, then we're going to have to look at other solutions. And then finally, propose recommendations for public consultation, which is the report that we put out a few weeks ago. Going on to the next slide. So, again, this will give you a rough idea of, I was talking before about open reporting versus closed reporting. Let me first say that most of our work and most of our recommendations really fundamentally focused on the open reporting scenario, which is the box on the left. And that is because that's where most of the problems exist. If you've got a closed reporting scenario, the cases that we looked at demonstrated that, for the most part, you could actually deal with any specific disclosures within those models. And we've got an example we'll look at later. But in the open reporting scenario, which again, to be so that everybody understood, I don't want to make any assumptions here. So again, open reporting, whether it's IFRS reporting or it's GAAP reporting or it's any other territory's reporting, you're basically saying you, as a preparer, have the ability to report this information in any number of different ways. The disclosure isn't locked down. You can do it, you know, A, B, or C, however you think is appropriate. Whereas in a closed reporting environment, it's more or less like a tax return. It's a form, right? Just fill it out. Those are so much easier to deal with, right? Night and day difference here. And so most of our issues are on the left, and that's what we were trying to really address. But I will tell you that from my perspective, we learned quite a bit from the closed reporting, because there are some tricks there. Tricks is a bad word. There are some techniques there that could be applied in an open reporting environment to help mitigate these extension elements as a result of ESDs. Going to the next slide. So when we wrapped all of this up, we really had three categories of entity-specific disclosures, or at least that we ended up focusing on. And I'll start with the last one. The standalone was actually where we kind of started the group. This is what we called orphaned elements. And it was, again, this premise that filers were extending things and they were being included in their disclosures, and there was no way to figure out what they were because it wasn't linked to the taxonomy and so on and so forth. After we studied a number of those, we came to recognize that these were just poorly modeled. 99 times out of 100, they were simply modeled poorly. Nothing actually should be orphaned. If it's orphaned, if it's truly orphaned, it probably doesn't belong in financial statements. Are there edge cases? Probably. But the overwhelming number of items we looked at ended up in one of the other categories. And so one of the key premises for starting the group actually has been taken off the table. Maybe revisited in some form later, but for now, it's orphaned. So the first two categories, disaggregation and aggregation, are the primary categories that we speak to and we talk about in our recommendation. So going to the next slide, this is disaggregation. This is our disaggregation example. So the basic idea is that you have an element, as in this case, you have amounts due from related parties non-current. That's the 177.7. And then the filer has chosen to break that out into three other items that in this case roll up. Now there are a variety of different scenarios for this, but this is an example of an aggregating base taxonomy element that has been broken out into other items. Now there are a couple of different ways to look at this, but the most important message here is if the aggregating item isn't reported, then those three extension items have nothing to be anchored to, right? And it's quite plausible that the filer would have only reported those three items because the amount due from related parties non-current is a subtotal, and one filer, one preparer might include it, another preparer might not. One of our recommendations would suggest that we need to somehow be including that, whether it's actually as an amount or simply as a relationship, which should be included in a fashion that you can understand the mathematical relationship here, the relationship of these items to the base taxonomy item, so that the user of the data can consume this and know what to do with them. At least it doesn't give them everything. It's not going to tell you that it's an associate. It's not going to tell you it's a joint venture. It's not going to tell you it's an invested company. But it will at least tell you that it's a related party and that it's non-current. You will pick up those attributes, those properties of that item. Next slide is the aggregation example. And so in this case, what we've used, what the preparer has used, is prepaid pension and post-retirement benefits as line items. And then we have an aggregation as, in any specific disclosure, the prepaid pensions and post-retirement benefits. So, again, a couple of ways to look at this. In this case, they're reporting the aggregated amount, the prepaid pensions and post-retirement benefits, probably not reporting the prepaid pension and post-retirement benefit line items. Could be, but the issue here is I've got this aggregation. How do I know it's in it? So again, we could provide relationships that tell you that this aggregation, this arbitrary aggregation, and we have these all the time. These are just subtotals or aggregations that a filer happens to think are relevant, combines multiple concepts from the base taxonomy. By providing this relationship, it helps us understand, it helps the user understand what that item is. So on our business requirements, so after going through all of that, and I think the comments I've made make this obvious, but the basic idea is that if we have explicit requirements for linkage of ESDs to the base taxonomy, so that's not something we have today, and again, I say we. I think ESMA has probably taken the strongest lead in terms of codifying some requirements around this. But absent that, I don't think there's any other project that has specifically come out and said you must do this, that, or the other thing to anchor your extension items, and this is how you should do it. Some of it happens because we have this dimensional construct, and the dimensional construct effectively contains extensions. We never thought about it. I didn't think about it that way in the beginning. But that's effectively what has happened. But we have all of these others, and we've never consciously thought about it. And so what we need is explicit guidance on how you can link an ESD to your base taxonomy, be it a disaggregation, as in the first case, or as an aggregation in the second case. And wherever possible, making sure that we're describing the mathematical relationships. Now, that's not always feasible given our current calculation specification, but XBRL International has undertaken the revision of the calculation specification within the spec group, and you know that's just getting underway now.
It's going fast.
What's that?
Very fast than I thought it would.
Yeah. So main recommendations. Now, these main recommendations are broken down into two categories. As I noted before, the first category is what I called earlier open reporting, but this is focused on prepare extension taxonomy. So in an open reporting environment, you're going to have extension taxonomies. In a closed reporting environment, you probably don't have any extension taxonomy. Everything is in the instance document. So in this scenario, we're recommending that a calculation link base is provided because it's the most useful link for ESDs based on existing mechanisms that we have. It can provide links for both categories of ESDs, for both aggregations and the disaggregations. And we can link those ESDs to the most appropriate base elements, irrespective of the presentation. So again, presentation can mean a whole variety of different things. A lot of times the calculation looks like the presentation, but it doesn't always, particularly as we get into inline. So it's important to focus on what is the relationship of the ESDs to the base taxonomy. And it can provide information about how elements relate mathematically to each other. I think that kind of goes without saying. There are some limitations. And again, this gets into my comment about XII taking on revisions to the calc spec. Some improvements are required to make it work the way we really want it to work. We all know that calculations have some problems in the sense that they don't work across dimensions. And so if you've got a, you know, you've got a simple filing, you can make the calculations work. But as soon as you introduce dimensions, all bets are off. There are some other issues with calculations. We were talking about this earlier with the notes that Rita was talking about, including because of the balance attribute and so on. Those are issues that create problems. Across period calculations, those don't work particularly well. They don't work at all. So there's some constraints, there's some limitations there that that reduce its benefit. And that gets to this third point, which is some functionality that allows us to, so when we get these non-validating relationships, some sort of mechanism that allows us to flag it or document it so that it doesn't drive preparers crazy. Because accountants don't like calculation inconsistencies. Absent those things working, and there are a variety of reasons why a calculation might not work. One of the first is that you might not actually require the use of calculation link bases in your reporting regime. And if you don't require it, it's kind of hard to use it. Even if you made it voluntary, it probably wouldn't work because the system might not deal with it very well. And so, you know, in those sort of situations, something else needs to be put in place. And again, in a reporting regime where the calculations are permitted, they still don't always work. A couple of different reasons. Can you go to the next slide, please? Thank you. Sometimes the calculations are just incomplete. So, you know, we've got... you know, if you look at the statement of shareholders' equity, is much stuff is going on there. There's very little in terms of calculations. So, and it's highly dimensionalized. So it's very hard to get something meaningful there that has a calculation under it. And so, you know, there are going to be cases where something else might need to be applied. And this is still pretty open-ended, I think, at this point. So this is the, you know, the primary recommendation for prepare for ESDs that do not require a prepare extension taxonomy. And the so for programs that are already doing this, they're probably good. But if you're starting a new program, there are techniques that can be utilized to contain any specific disclosures within those projects. And the example that we have on the next slide really just spells it out better than words on a page. And I don't know, is this from the UK project? Andy, do you know if this is from the UK?
Oh, probably.
Probably.
Looks UK-ish to me.
It is from the UK project.
Yeah, yes. So it's really, you know, and the UK project is always been interesting. We learned quite a bit from what they've done here, and it's this idea that so in theory extend, but I don't think folks actually extend. I don't know. Have there been any extensions today?
So there have been some extensions. So it is possible to create an extension for filing in the UK, but not in Ireland. But there are very, very few.
Very few. And part of the reason is they built the taxonomy out in a manner with a focus on being able to contain these in any specific disclosures. And so in this particular example, what they've done is they've created members for things that you might anticipate as extensions. Now, what this picture doesn't show you, which as I was looking at this before, I realized, you know, it would have been helpful to have some line items under this to fully appreciate what's going on here. But the idea is that you, I would imagine in this case, you've got some line items that relate to different properties of property, plant, and equipment, and then your different categories you're breaking out. And if you've got something that is not provided for you in the members, you're just going to use one of these. The same thing is done in segment reporting, where they've provided segment one, segment two, segment three. And what you do to identify the segment is you have a separate line item that actually provides you the name of the segment. Now, in substance, if you've already doing an extension taxonomy, I don't think you're getting different information. But if your focus is on minimizing the need for an extension taxonomy, that's a really clever way of containing that information within the instance document itself. And so there's some...
It has some limitations, which we don't seem to have a slide for, which is just that the taxonomy has to be able to predict where those entity-specific disclosures are going to occur. Hmm. So it works brilliantly where you've got a disclosure requirement that says quite specifically in the standard, and now provide me with this set of entity-specific information in these following categories. Because then you know the categories that are going to happen. You can put the general category in the taxonomy, and you can put it in the right place. What these mechanisms don't cope so well with are entity-specific subtotals that can pop up all over the place, and any kind of entity-specific disclosure which somebody is including for their own materiality reasons, or just basically they occur in unpredictable locations. They're not something that can be resisted. So this is really, really useful if you've got predictable points of entity-specific disclosure, and the user knows exactly which ones they want. Then they can define the taxonomy to say, right, contain the ones that I want to use. If you've got a situation where the users might want to use anything, or they might want to use it across the whole taxonomy, then this starts to be less useful.
The second observation, much like guidelines on creating creating actual taxonomy extensions, which sometimes aren't followed, and the quality of those extensions can be poor because items are items are built in Solo and aren't linked back to the base taxonomy, is that this does provide that linking. So it's very clear that you do have a disaggregation and where that disaggregation
is. Oh, yeah, the linking is there. It's the restrictions aren't around whether or not the linking information is there. The restrictions are around whether or not you can predict the user's requirements and also where the entity-specific disclosure will occur.
And with the lack of actual extensions, you potentially, as John mentioned earlier, you lack the information to be able to further inform that model from one year to the next. So you're, during the design of the taxonomy, it's common practice around where do we think there's likely to be common disaggregations, and then you curate this model to allow them to be able to do so. However, in year two and year three, you've got filings and data coming in. There are no actual extensions to inform what is the actual common practice, unless you get back to the traditional PDF form and do a manual analysis.
So that would be because they have chosen to...
It's because they're not being tagged.
Right. So they're not providing the information.
Anything that's not being tagged, you can't then analyse for future use to enhance your taxonomy unless you go and do it manually. But that's a gap in the filing rules. That's not related to the way of the taxonomy is designed necessarily. It just happens to be that these mechanisms are often used with partial tagging regimes.
True.
It's not actually the limit on the mechanisms themselves. It's when they've been used so far.
So this wraps up this portion. I don't know if you wanted to go to the next portion or open it up for questions.
I think let's open it first, open for questions, and then we go on to the next. Is there any questions on this particular area? Any ideas? Yes.
Please. Are you...
Yes. You first. Beep time.
I just had a quick question. So it seems like we're overloading the calculation relationship a little bit, so we have a lot of examples in U.S. data where people have extended, and then those extensions are a part of a calculation. Not everywhere, but we have a lot of data that says that. So did people say that was enough to interpret what those extensions meant?
I think that's a fair point. And...
I do think most people viewed it as it's an acceptable solution for where we are now, meaning that they could adequately interpret the information based on it, but it wasn't viewed as perfect or ideal. I mean, again, that's part of the reason XII is taking another pass at calculations. We talked at length about all sorts of alternatives that would be more perfect, but at the end of the day, we ended up with what I would think is a pragmatic.
Well, there's another reason for the focus on calculation, which is that we were looking at numeric ATC-specific disclosures, and the primary thing that people would like to do if they're analyzing those numeric disclosures is know where they roll up to. It's understand which top-level concepts they want to analyze they roll up to, or understand how they break down. And we kind of already have a mechanism for that. It just wasn't designed for this purpose. So you're right in that, to a certain extent, it's trying to overload the thing that we have with its originally designed purpose. But that's why some of the recommendations we passed over were to say, actually, we need something that allows us to document roll-up and calculation information, as opposed to the current functionality, which is primarily trying to validate calculations and roll-ups that exist. So there are two different... And the reason the work was handed over was a set of requirements, not a set of this is what spec changes we'd like you to make, is because it's not necessarily the case that that spec change does result in stuff that just happens to the calculation link base. It might happen elsewhere. That wasn't really the thing that we were trying to do. We were trying to set the requirements. The spec group's job, and I'm going to say you because I happen to know that Susan sits on the spec group.
You happen to know that I am doing this work on calculations, yes.
You need to take those requirements and decide where it is actually the best idea to make right. The fixes and changes that will sort out those business requirements.
It
is possible that some of those problems are fixed outside the calculation link base in other specifications, but the aim is to improve the way that that calculation information is available, because we were trying to sort out the automated consumption of these disclosures.
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed,
automated roll-up and inclusion in spreadsheets and roll-ups that are trying to do numerical analysis.
I mean, as we discussed, there are certain scenarios where the calculations are incomplete or don't even come into play, where we need to express relationships. And
right, that's what
we haven't exactly we have not exactly solved that one.
The good thing
calculations
about numeric disclosures,
will cover
though,
a lot.
Is that the calculations, if with the gaps filled, do cover the vast majority of what people would like to do with numbers in a financial statement.
Pareto principle too, right? Yes, there are other things, but
fix the big problem.
Big ticket items first.
Yeah. Yes. Clara, you wanted to add something?
So I don't underestimate the challenge that those on the spec group working on the new calculation link base face, in part because it's many of the same challenges faced by the former specification. And those who've ever had experience writing XBL formulas know it's not the easiest thing to do. One of the requirements of the calculation link base, call it 2.0 or whatever we like, would be almost that software used by preparers can actually modify it, maintain it, and extend it to represent the financial report which they're representing. And to do so transparently abstract to the user. That's going to take some work. It's going to take some work to get right. Many of the mechanisms which exist in the world today, which solve these problems, they look very strong, and very quickly you can say, "Oh, I'm a proponent of that. Let's put this into this other taxonomy project." But you very quickly find lots of really good reasons why they fall apart. And this example on screen from the UK, for example, doesn't work when there are themselves subtotals within the disaggregations.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the things we identified, is you lose subtotal structure within disaggregations when you bundle them anonymously.
All of these cases also require that not only the preparers, but also the consumers of data, have software that knows that this modelling exists. Because in the absence of the software knowing that this, call it proprietary modelling exists, you don't actually make accurate use of the data. And so that represents a challenge. So from an ISB perspective, the work that we did around the IFRS taxonomy architecture is really important. And we'll probably need to have another look at that as the new calculation link base and those sorts of things come out, to think about, well, how do we do this in a consistent way recognizing our heritage as well, so that the data it, when prepared, doesn't represent a burden, obviously, but it also makes sense when analyzing. It's going to be a difficult transition.
Thanks, Carly.
Was there a question?
No, I didn't think there was.
I didn't think there was.
Just some words of encouragement.
So do you have a question or comment?
Just kind of a general observations. One of the sort of open platform. So if I see something in US GAAP, axis, let's say regions of countries axis, which is not available in IFRS. If I'm using IFRS filing, can I use, based on open platform, US GAAP well-defined axis into IFRS?
I think, Ashok, that is a question that we need to take offline. I think this is not directly related to
I was going to say, I was going to say you should attend the Expro US webinar the first week of May, where Mike and I will talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That brings me...
Mike will talk about that.
I think that's the right forum to discuss it rather than here. Today.
What's the date of the webinar, Mike? I don't remember.
Bring my second question, that this group, you've done wonderful things, and I'm sure you will do. The relationship between your group, so-called advisory group, to the standard setter and the regulator. I mean, all the things doing wonderful study. How does it really, at the end of the day, as far as the filer is concerned, think about the filers rather than all, the so-called academic or whatever the thing you're thinking of. What would be, the impact, the relationship between these three? Advisory group advise, the standard setter, they may have different view, and finally the regulator.
Well, if you're referring to the task force, I think that's where John comes in, because the task force sits under Expro International. So this ESDTF stuff is an Expro International piece of work sitting under their best practices board. And that means that it can then be propagated centrally via the body whose job it is to look after Expro standards. So that's where the relationship out to the regulators, to the standard setters comes. And it's why I'm sitting here as an external observer occasionally answering questions, because I'm co-chair from Expirel International. I've got that hat on. And John can answer that in more detail, I think, probably. Although he may not like me for passing the question over.
No, I think you answered it perfectly well. I mean, just as the International Accounting Standards Board can't tell a country what to do, we can't tell a country or a regulator what to do. We can point out the pros and cons of this. We're pointing out very strongly, wherever we can, the importance of consistency for comparability, the importance of these kinds of issues for consumption. And preparers are very important, but you're not as important as users. in our minds, I guess. It's like, what is reporting for? It's for use.
It is worth saying that we do say in the published recommendations that while the automated use was the primary goal, the thing we really wanted to achieve with the recommendations, we did bear in mind that we did not want to create a prohibitive cost for preparers, because doing so would eventually have a knock-on effect on the usability of the data, obviously.
But their requirements,
that was in the list of considerations.
Their requirements are different. Yeah. Right? I mean, we were focused on this in terms of maximizing utility for the users with due consideration for the impact on preparers.
And so three really quick points. We know, looking at Anna, that we've got to get the new calculation spec done. That doesn't need to happen, is happening. But that, once it's baked into tools, so it's a little way away, but once it's baked into tools, should make some of these things much simpler, in our view. So thank you very much for all the work of the ESCTF.
Solve some other problems, too.
Solve some other problems as well. Thank you to the ISB for the focus on subtotals, because some of these things, some of the most frequent issues that we seem to trip across relate to subtotals which aren't required or aren't in a disclosure and then cause footing problems and cause confusion. So I think that approach really helps digital representation of financial statements. And the third thing I wanted to say is that nobody will let me call it supercalc, which I just think is mean.
I've got one general question for you, Liz. In the beginning of your presentation, you had three categories: aggregated, disaggregated, standalone.
Mm-hmm.
You dropped standalone because it didn't quite line up with something you could address.
Right.
And you were noticing that there was challenges with the modeling. What did you do with it when you dropped it?
Yeah, so let me clarify. Standalone, what at the time we referred to as orphaned elements, was, as it was first brought to us, the issue of extension elements, right? This didn't start out as a discussion of any specific disclosure. It was users, primarily data aggregators, saying these extension elements, that's the worst thing ever. Don't allow extensions. I mean, that was the number one complaint. We hate extensions, don't want extensions. We don't know what to do with them. They're going to fall. They fall on the floor. And then we were seeing, they were pointing out specific scenarios where these extensions weren't anchored to anything. So it was not uncommon. So in a US GAAP XBRL exhibit, you'd have a disclosure where the parent element in the disclosure was an extension, and then the children under it were extensions. And that parent element might have been nothing more than an abstract, but basically everything is an extension, and it just didn't tie back to anything in the primary financial statements or any other disclosures. So we referred to that as orphaned, right? It had no real home anywhere. So the consumer of the data, they just ignored it. If they're trying to do a quick pull of the data, they're just going to ignore it. Once we started looking at those cases more closely, what we recognized that in most cases, it was really just modeled poorly. It wasn't that they were orphaned. They just hadn't been created correctly in the first place. If they had been modeled appropriately, they would have actually been anchored back to the taxonomy, but they weren't. Now,
so they weren't orphan disclosures. The disclosures were perfectly sensible, and if you looked at them from a standard perspective, they tied back to things that were in the base standards nicely. It's that the XBRL tagging wasn't tying them back to stuff in the base taxonomy nicely. So when we tried to look for examples of disclosures that were genuinely, if the calculation link base was working perfectly, if people were tagging perfectly, we tried to look for disclosures that would genuinely sit there and be orphaned, and there really aren't very many of them because, unsurprisingly, people are reporting against the framework of the standard. So when they're putting stuff in, it's usually in response to something in that standard. So what we discovered was where lots of people were, users were complaining that this thing was sitting in the XBRL tagging without the appropriate relationships. It was because one of the other things we discussed, it was a bit where the calculation link base couldn't cover. It was where the tagging rules hadn't been applied properly, which we'd kind of declared is out of scope and a future topic and is more to do with the regulators' tagging rules and various things like that. And we discovered that actual orphan disclosures, forget the tagging, orphan disclosures are really, really rare. So if we can fix all the other problems, they're going to be such a small part of the system that we really need to sit there and kind of spend a lot of our time coming up with a solution in XBRL to cover them.
Okay, so that's where I was going with it. So if anything to address that is in train through something else.
Sorry, say that again.
Anything to address the issue is being addressed through calculation link based or something else. There isn't any value left in there, or any other changes left that we should be looking at. Does that make sense?
Not for real orphans, no. Yeah,
no.
Effectively, they kind of, that the whole 80-20 problem thing, they kind of fall as a really difficult problem that may not actually have any reason for us to cover it because the user's really going to be looking at these things anyway automatically. They're probably going to require manual review, whatever we do with the technology, at least until we get some better language processing and so on. That can
for true orphan, what we hadn't recognized in the start, for something to be truly orphan, it's not related to the reporting requirements. It's something completely outside the scope of the reporting requirements. And it's pretty nonsensical for that to exist within the financial statements. It can happen, but it's going to be pretty rare, or it's going to be one or two facts in the context of a report, something that's required to be disclosed. And so that may have been what got the conversation started, but it turned out not to be really the core issue. And again, remember that in the case of the SEC project, and I'm sure this is true of many others, there wasn't a specific requirement that said, hey, by the way, you need to make sure everything ties back to the base taxonomy. I don't think that is an idea we had thought about, you know, a few years ago.
John, there will be a section, if all this goes in place, a section of disclosures that don't yet fall out of scope of the ESTDTF. Example would be in a litigation footnote, you say, you know, there's a lawsuit related to our 500-foot pipeline in California. The 500 needs to be tagged, and so you'd create an extension for it because it's pretty odd and unusual. But what do you hook anchor that to? There's really nothing. There's no calculation. I can't think of a tag. So that would fall into this category of let's just leave it there and let someone read it. Read the sentence or text block tag.
That's the narrative.
Yeah. Or
500-foot pipeline. 500
foot.
That's an amount that needs to be tagged.
Yeah.
We have a lawsuit related to our 500-foot pipeline in California.
Yeah, but that's
under the SEC rules.
But that's when you write a comment letter to Mike saying, you know, this thing about every number being tagged.
I would suspect in the context of the entire disclosure, it's probably dimensionally reported anyway.
Yeah, you might have a dimension related to that litigation.
I'm sorry, but that number in the context of that disclosure is no different than 2% milk.
Okay.
And we've explicitly explained that example. Now,
yeah.
There might be another one you want to use.
Yeah, there is another one I want to use. You know, we had 24 stores in California.
That's a KPI.
What do we do with that one?
Well, no, the 24 stores is a measurement that's actually directly related to your business. It's no different than in the Delta report, they have 325 airplanes that they're committed to purchase.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very relevant to that.
No, I think
I would tag it, but there's no anchor for it. It's an extension, and there's no anchor for it.
This is your point about orphans.
I tend to agree
with you. I was going to ask them the same question after the meeting.
Yeah, there's going to be a population of orphans like that. And I can think of a few more examples.
If we can come up with some good cases at the time, they just were not showing up.
And a lot of people said what you just said. Don't tag stupid stuff like that.
But remember
those fair value inputs we had up there, like the actual cost of capital and discount rate? Let's say ABC is another input that's an extension.
From my standpoint, I've got my question answered.
Okay, fine.
but do it offline.
Yeah,
we got it a bit more, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a huge topic here, I think, and I don't think we will come to sensible any things here. I think the issues as raised, like the number of stores, you could say, look, this is possibly an operating metrics type of taxonomy, not anymore an IFRS taxonomy or US GAAP taxonomy. So it opens so many avenues, which I think it's worth exploring, but probably maybe at another time, not at this moment in time, because of the other topics we still have to bring.
Yeah.
So with that, Anna, do you want to?
Yes, so as a way of introduction, I'd like to spend a few words to explain what this project was all about and why we came up with it. So I'll be very brief, but in 2013, a revision of the Transparency Directive mandated ESMA, which is the European Securities and Markets Authority, to come up with new rules for the European Union to come up with the rules regarding a single electronic format in which issuers would have to file their annual financial reports. So ESMA has published last December in 2017 the draft rules for the European single electronic format, also called the ESEF, to specify such a reporting format. So the format that I called it draft rules at the moment because this is a draft, it's a regulatory technical standard that ESMA submits to the European Commission, after which the legislative process, which those of you who are acquainted with the European decision-making process might know, it has still to be negotiated by the European Parliament and the European Council. So it's currently undergoing that process. In the meantime, the RTSs are publicly available on our website, but they're not yet law. and as such not yet applicable. So the objectives that the transparency directives gave for this new electronic format are to make reporting easier for issuers, facilitate accessibility, analysis, and comparability, most critical for this session of annual financial reports. So the format that the RTSs on SF propose for annual financial statements from the year 2020 is XHTML. And whenever annual financial reports contain consolidated financial statements, the draft rules on SF require those financial statements to be tagged to make those label disclosures structured and machine readable. And this, as you all know, allows machine readable information to be available and label disclosures to be structured. Furthermore, in a constituency like the European Union, the fact that machine information is that disclosures are machine readable means that allows comparison across languages, because this tagged information can be translated basically instantaneously by users. So getting into the details of what the draft RTS foresee on what we're talking about today, so the entity-specific disclosure, ESMA is suggesting that issuers can can use entity-specific disclosures, provided that each disclosure is anchored to an element in the core taxonomy. Yes, of course, the SF is suggesting that is used in the IFRS taxonomy, or rather an extension of it, with a few added elements to the core elements provided by the IFRS taxonomy. So, as the slide says, extension elements need to be anchored to an element in the core taxonomy using a wider, narrow relationship, which has been defined in the ESMA extension taxonomy. And the idea is that every extension needs to be anchored to the element that has the closest wider accounting meaning. It can also be tagged. It can also be anchored to that to a narrower accounting meaning, but that's optional. And whenever extension taxonomy element combines several elements of the base taxonomy, the issuer needs to anchor those narrow elements to the extension taxonomy element. Subtotals instead are not do not need necessarily to be anchored. Elements do not need to be anchored to any subtotals. This has been a result of observations during the field test that we carried out to test the proposed rules during summer 2017, in which we came to realize that calculations were provided already enough information to users, and so we didn't want to overburden preparers with this other requirement. This was the compromise that ESMA found most reasonable in replying to complying with the requirements of our mandate, which is to increase comparability between financial statements of different firms, but at the same time allow issuers to tell their own story in their reports. So in a way, in this through this mechanism, which we called anchoring, the creativity of issuers can still be expressed, but by relayed back to the IFRS element. In a way, it provides for a consumer a way to compare financial statements across within the same sector, also across sectors, but at the same time does not limit what they can put in there. So if you move to the next slide, I'd like to illustrate an example of how an anchor will work with the P&L of a European issuer. So in this example, we would have the elements in blue, so revenue and revenue from rendering of information technology service, which are elements contained in the IFRS taxonomy, to which we would need to anchor the elements, the extension elements, that would be created by the issuer, the preparer. So the preparer would create the extension elements, those extension elements in green would not need to anchor the subtotals, which are the ones surrounded with the black arrow, and would only need to anchor to the IFRS taxonomy the most granular level of disclosure, which is the software license, software support, and cloud subscription and support. And we need to anchor that to the element contained in the IFRS taxonomy, which is, in this case is revenue from rendering of information technology services. Moving on to the next slide is another example, this time of combinations. And in this, we have an example from another balance sheet of a European issuer in which the element existing in the financial statements is share capital and premium, which then does not exist as such in the IFRS taxonomy, core taxonomy, which instead has two separate narrow elements, which are issued capital and share premium. So in this case, the preparer would need to anchor its extension elements, share capital and premium, to those two narrower elements. So in this case, the anchoring would indicate a wider debt extension element is wider than the taxonomy element. So these are our draft rules, and obviously there's many more details that can be that we can discuss, but these are the main rules on anchoring that we're suggesting. As I said, this is not law yet. It's still undergoing a legislative process of endorsement. That's how we call it. And if anyone has any questions.
Yeah, maybe the first question, because we still don't understand this anchoring concept. So what SMS says as an added value of the anchoring, because if the preparer really defines it as an extension and you find it in a specific disclosure, and disclosure is already structured in a way, what is really the benefit of this anchoring? So did ESMA also consider like what's the extra burden which the preparer has to do for this anchoring? And second question is, why did ESMA not, if you just take this simple example here, why did ESMA also thought about extending the taxonomy? I mean, because if you exactly know this is a disaggregating element, it's not necessarily the preparer's fault, but it's also a fault of the taxonomy that it's not detailed enough. So why anchoring, giving it to the preparer? Because you could also say, use a kind of different reporting element. So these are the two questions I would like to raise.
So I think the objective of permitting an anchoring mechanism is to ensure comparability and ensure that machine-readable information can actually be compared across different firms. At the moment, if you only use an extension element and do not relate it back to an element in the core taxonomy, technically that is not machine-usable in the sense that it's not comparable to anything from another firm. Whilst from the moment in which, even if the anchoring does not mean that you can compare apples with apples, you're not comparing apples with elephants, you know, you're comparing apples with pears. So you're approaching elements that are going to be quite similar, and this feeds into a process of comparison, which is richer in a way than of a non-anchored extension element, which is completely non-related to the core taxonomy. So this is the objective that ESMA pursued, and I think there was a cost-benefit analysis, and this was tested during the field test last summer. The effort required by issuers was deemed to be not excessive in the sense that during a 1.5-day workshop, with the help of the IFRS Foundation, with the IFRS taxonomy staff, we managed to tag financial statements of a number of issuers without this being a big burden, using actually quite rudimentary tools, in the sense that tools that were not adapted to the SF rules yet. So we imagine that the work with EAT will be even diminished once the rules are out in the market and software vendors can adapt their specifications to them. So I reckon, I mean, there is a range, there is a set of compromises that need to be made. One, on the one hand, you have the facility of preparers at the cost of preparers, and on the other hand, you have the maximum, the opposite end of the scale, you have total comparability across across different filings. So we think that the anchoring is the best compromise we could come to, as I said earlier, to ensure that issuers can tell their own story but still relate it to the standards and to the core taxonomy elements whilst limiting the cost and limiting the work to them as little as possible.
Lewis, you will.
Yeah, but first, if I might add to what you said, you know, one of the biggest criticisms we have for the XBRL U.S. taxonomy, amongst many, is how big it is, right? And so the idea that ESMA or I4S could simply add more elements to get the coverage you're looking for, it's an unending process. And we have had at least one data aggregator say, stop already, focus on anchoring the extension so I can understand what they are. Because it's a never-ending process. And so if we had a robust mechanism in place for anchoring extensions, users of the information would be able to figure out what the information is. And it would solve some problems. It obviously creates some additional complication for preparers, but it does solve a lot of problems. And I think it's also important to recognize, maybe less so in this example, but the prior example, much of this actually happens already anyway. Really what we're doing with promulgating guidance around extensions is saying you must do it. It's explicit as opposed to some sort of implied, and then it's just not given a lot of thought. Anyway, my question. sorry. On this example here, and in the general statement before that, where it says we're not anchoring extension elements, so it kind of goes to what I was just saying, aren't the extension elements for subtotals, aren't they anchored by default? Is that why it's not a requirement? Is it understood that they are being anchored, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. That was really all I had, in spite of the preamble.
Mike, you had something?
Yes. You mentioned that it's a proposal idea. Is that on the website someplace?
Yes. It is currently on ESMA's website.
Did you send around a link, or is it in the
I'll
deck?
I'll send around a link.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And Chi, you?
Okay. Yeah, I just want to share in the information. We mean Edinet, is a Japanese filing system, used to have a similar mechanism. Edinet taxonomy have a definition linked on all items, and then the company before, a company has to like link to, when company make an extension, the company has to link from item with items in a standard taxonomy. So that we can know the basically we can know logically we can know these extension items is how these extension items linked with standards taxonomy. But now stopped it. The reason is the code users quite hard to believe that this is really correct or not. So this links nobody checked it. So that if the presentation link role anybody can see, but this link is not this link. Our link wasn't checked by anyone. So that maybe you will face a similar problem. So that in that case maybe I think my personal opinion is auditor check might be necessary. Because how we can trust it, those items is linked, because it's not human checked. We expected to use these tags by automatically systems. So that someone has to check it. Is really those extension is children or parents of the standard item.
Thanks,
Jim.
And we've got one more from Marshall, then.
I've got the impression today you've just been through a big sort of 20F tagging project. So just a reminder with ESEF that we're just looking primarily at the 5 pages of primary financial statements. So I think although anchoring will be common for each filer, it's not going to be that many occasions on each filing that it's done. But then sort of the second question in terms of, well, shouldn't the taxonomies be sort of catering for that? I'm sure that very quickly there'll be a large amount of data in terms of extensions, and then the board here, the body here, can sort of consider whether they build them into the taxonomy.
But the anchoring will really help the ISB understand what those extensions are.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because now when we look at extensions...
May I also add that the draft rules on SF only foresee block tagging for the notes. So we don't have detail tagging for the notes, only block tagging starting, according to the draft proposal, 2 years after the entry into force of the rules. That will further simplify and lighten the burden for issuers compared to the experience in the US.
Thanks, Anna. Yep. Is that the end of your...
No,
you've got more?
No, sorry.
No, no, to read. I think you're... Yeah, thank you. And I was wondering if you have more.
Pardon?
Are you continuing?
I'll continue now. Okay, because as an Avres taxonomy team, we also have been looking and we have been participating and cooperating with XBRL International and ESMA on these anchoring rules and on the new linking functionality we've been proposed. And we had given some preliminary thoughts of what that really can mean for us as a team, for the Avres taxonomy and so on. We want to just share with you these preliminary thoughts. I'm saying they are preliminary because I'm sure other things will come in the thing. So what we are thinking at the moment, taking in consideration what we have, we don't think there's going to be an immediate significant impact on the content and the architecture of the taxonomy as such. Possibly in the future, there may be some architectural or data model decisions that we may have to change, but we don't see them in the short term. We, however, and that has been already alluded a few times here at the meeting, we are quite excited by these new processes, by this anchoring, because we think it's going to help us significantly in the identification of new common practice content. Yeah, we also think that at this moment in time, the equivalent elements that currently exist in the taxonomy will have to continue to exist, at least in the short or medium term. And we don't think that we should change the taxonomy to include the more taxonomy extensible specific features, as Lewis showed an example from how you could do that. So if you go to the next slide, Vladek, yeah. So why do we think that there are going to be process changes for common practice? At the moment, the way we analyze common practice, we go manual through the financial statements. We try to map them. We try to order and structure them. We try to organize all this information to come up with some kind of conclusions, should we add additional common practice elements or not. Now, if we have all this anchoring, if we have this new great calculation link base that can really show us the link between extension and the base taxonomy, it becomes much easier for us. Because we can really use these links to say, okay, these extensions, for this particular element, base taxonomy element, we have lots of extensions. These are all the extensions that the preparer has linked to this base taxonomy element. Let's see if we can find some commonality within these extensions linked to this element using then either labels or other kinds of technologies. Also, we think that, in fact, often we ask, okay, on which area should we focus our common practice content? Now, clearly, if we can see particular areas, elements where there are lots of extensions, or if we see particular extensions that are linked to very high-level concepts such as equity or assets, then probably these are areas where we have to look at. And a good example was, again, from the ESMA workshop, we saw that there was a particular area where preparers were always linking this to equity, which we thought was a quite high level. And when we looked at it a little bit more in detail, it was really that we didn't have in the taxonomy elements to capture financial instruments that have characteristics with equity, which obviously is very important to investors, and we should really focus on that. Then a second, and we hope that in the future we can look at common practice in that way. A second, and if you go to the next slide, Vladek, a second thing we thought about is, should we be more selective? And again, this Dirk, you said, okay, at more elements. But again, we got the same feedback that Lewis got for there is something as an optimal taxonomy size. If investors have to look at a taxonomy that has 20,000 elements, I think just by looking at it would already scare that person, I think. So there is this idea of an optimal taxonomy size. Now, at this moment in time, we say, okay, we add an element as common reporting practice if within our sample 10% or more of entities report that element. Is this 10% benchmark set? Should we set that benchmark higher? Should we increase it from 10% to 30% or even 50%? Yeah? And especially, should we increase that benchmark for elements that are aggregations? Yeah, because an element that is an aggregation, in fact, by having this anchoring mechanism, by having the components of an aggregation, a software can derive some meaning of it. And I give you, and this is a real problem we face when we currently analyze common practice. Imagine that a taxonomy has elements for general expenses, administrative expenses, distribution expenses. So we have three, let's say, now lower-level child elements. Now, when we look at primary financial statements, there are companies that may say, okay, selling and distribution expenses. There are companies that say selling and administrative expenses. So there are lots of combinations. And there are companies who say, and which is very high in reporting, is selling, general, and administrative expenses. Now, at this moment in time, based on a benchmark criteria of 10%, we may include, for instance, something like a combination like selling and general expenses, even if it's only reported by 10%. In the future, I think we have to think a little bit more clever about, because if we have these components, children elements, and by anchoring, a user can make sense of it. Yeah? However, it would still be useful to have these more high-level aggregations, elements, if these elements are commonly used in investment analysis or if they're reported by a large amount of preparers. Like, for instance, the example of selling general administrative expenses, this would be a good aggregation to have in our taxonomy because it's something that could be used as a high-level anchor point for investors to screen on, and it could also be used by an element to really have all these other combinations link up to that high-level element. So these are the kind we have no great answers for it at the moment. I really feel by considering taxonomy size, by considering anchoring, we think we have to start thinking differently about our benchmark criteria for common practice as well. Then another implication, if you move to the next slide. And you know that our taxonomy currently has what we call equivalent items. Or you can call it, I don't like to use the word, but sometimes you call them duplicates or different ways of tagging. A good example is, for instance, we have in our taxonomy a line item for bearer plants, but we also have a member to bearer plants. Now, this has an implication because it really means as an investor, if I want to map to my model bearer plants, I have to use two elements. As a preparer, I may have to have, I may map to two elements. So it would be it's an overload that does not need to be there. However, at the moment, it has to be there because, again, through the constraints of the calculation link base, if you really want to validate your primary financial statements, generally at this moment in time, that means you need to tag it using line items. And regulators put then also constraints on the use of members on the primary financial statements. So if we have a calculation link base that can now handle all these additional functionalities, then we don't have these constraints anymore. And then we can consider to see, look, can we possibly delete some of these items? But then again, we have to consider, okay, a transitioning, because some people have been using these elements at all, so we may not do it for the existing elements, but in the future, then for new elements, we may not have to create equivalent elements. So we are also looking very carefully to what XBRL International is doing on the calculation link base. Then the third, if you move to the next slide, So the third topic is really, should our IFRS taxonomy include some of the extensible features that, for instance, exist in the UK FRC taxonomy? And we have been thinking about that now for a while. And I think the conclusions and using anchoring, we think, no, we should not include in our taxonomy extensible features. Because the way I would like anchoring to be portrayed is to say, I would say anchoring is a communication tool. What is proposed in the XBRL International Entity Specific Disclosure Task Force, it is a communication tool. Think for a minute if a preparer provides an entity-specific disaggregation. So if an entity, if a preparer, for instance, says, okay, I have impairment of my factory in Brazil, and also say, I have impairment of machinery, I'm making a top here now, for this particular and for this particular reason. So if you're a human reader, how do you communicate that entity, these two entity-specific facts? A reader will look at this, they will say, okay, it's a label. These are things which relate to impairment, and these are specific kind of impairments relating to this factory in Brazil and relating to this machinery. That's how you communicate an entity-specific disclosure in a paper format. Now, how do you do that? Because you need to communicate that also more in an electronic format. How do you do this? Now, from the prepare viewpoint, by creating an extension element and giving these extensions the specific labels, your labels, like impairment of factory X in Brazil, you're already communicating it. If that's all what you're communicating, and if I am a user of that information, it gives me nothing. The only thing I have here now is that you're giving me the label, and in front of the label you have put some kind of prefix that says, look, this is my entity-specific fact. That's all what you as preparer has given. So really saying, by having to say, if a preparer would say, okay, in an electronic world, I'm now going to say, this is an extension with this label, and I linked it to the IFRS taxonomy element impairment, now you're telling the user, okay, these are impairment, yeah? You can still, like Anna already said, you can still compare between other companies that have impairment. But if as a user, I'm not only interested in comparability, but also I want to deep dive more in what impairment meant for that particular preparer, I can still do that in tools as well. Because within a tool, what can I do in a consumption tool? I can say here is impairment of property, plant, and equipment that exists for all preparers who have reported impairment. And if, as user, I want to understand more what this particular preparer has reported for impairment, I can then deep dive in the extension elements which have been linked to this base taxonomy element impairment. That's why I like to think about this more as a communication tool rather than some kind of technical solution. And we also like to say, okay, by doing that, it also gives us, if we move to the next slide, sorry. We also have to say, okay, yes, these kind of extensible features that you can use in a taxonomy, we could include that in the IFRS taxonomy, but then there are some, like it has been already, someone mentioned already, there are some elements in the taxonomy that are quite predictable. If the standard says you need to give a disaggregation of revenue by product, you know that they're going to be entity-specific products, and therefore you can do it. But then, in principle, a preparer could give a disaggregation of nearly every element that exists in the IFRS taxonomy. So we prefer more to give the preparer the tool to communicate a disaggregation rather than us trying to predict where in the taxonomy should we include disaggregations. And of course, we have to look also at the resources if we were to go that approach. And we have to consider that regulators may want to use taxonomy in different ways. So if particular regulators still feel, look, we would like to include this taxonomy and extensible features because it works for my particular way of how I want data to be used within my particular jurisdiction. You still have the option to do that, but it doesn't constrain regulators who do not prefer to go that option. And these are the kind of implications, ideas we currently have. And if you have, do you agree with these implications? Do you think, as a taxonomy team, we should think at other things? Or do you have any particular views on this?
So this isn't a question, just so we're clear, it's an observation. So the observation, so if we look at XBRO reporting going back over the last seven or 8 years, and every single mandate in every country, from the US to the UK to Italy and so forth, and ask what the most common error is in reporting, is going to be getting the sign wrong on the tag. And the reason I mention that is because choosing the appropriate sign of the value we're reporting is something that requires a human, requires a man to apply judgment when
or a woman.
Of course.
Scarier when a man applies judgment.
Well, the women wouldn't really
possibly an AI in the future. Yeah. It requires the application of judgment, and yet the most common error isn't actually applying the signage. So if we are inventing mechanisms which require a compound use of creating calculations, adding linkages, extending and so forth, and each step requires an AI or a woman or a man to apply judgment, you're going to increase the number of errors. That's just the reality. To the extent that we can work with software vendors to take some of those manual steps away, we can reduce some of those errors, especially where you can apply some kind of common approach. And so I think that there's a really big task here to work within XBRO International on standards, yes, but also with the software development community to find standard ways of actually doing it, the process of how do you go about it, to remove the manual application where it's not required and it can be tied in automatically.
Thanks, Tom. Derek?
Yeah, well, also, well, just to comment also on what Peter said with regard to the benchmark, what is the right benchmark? I think, first of all, I think we really have to differentiate between principle-based and rule-based taxonomy. I think that's really, my point of view, you cannot simply say US GAAP, it's rule-based, and then you can directly compare it with a principle-based taxonomy, because it really makes it a big difference with regard to number of reporting elements, because conceptually what you would expect is in the principle-based taxonomy much more reporting elements as in the US GAAP, because the US GAAP is very much defined by industry and so on. So conceptually, what we see right now is not actually what you really expect. But the comment I would really wanted to make with regard to ESMA is there we have a complete different situation, because we have all these member states who now have to report in XBRL, which are very, very much disaggregated, you would say, if you compare it with other regions like the US or now the SEC. So you really have the challenge how you want to combine this all in one taxonomy. And based on that conception, I think you need to have other benchmarks. You need to really extend the elements because your preparer are changing dramatically. Mm-hmm. And that's something I would just bring into the discussion about thinking, because that's a big, or will be, in my point of view, big change also for acceptance of the IFRS taxonomy in the future.
No, and I would say that, Dirk, so we will definitely review the extensions, yeah? So, and if we really feel, look, there is some additional common reporting practice, we'll include that in the taxonomy. Do I think we will identify some additional common reporting practice on that? I think yes. The answer to that is probably yes. But the thing is, like, I think it's more from, do you really want to increase the taxonomy to such a size that you cover each more entity-specific disclosure? that the answer to that is not. The answer to that is no, and therefore we would like to rely more on communication tools. And I think Lewis made it very clear at the beginning to say what is an entity-specific disclosure is something that's quite entity-specific, really, something specific to the entity and probably belongs very well in an entity-specific taxonomy, but with some links back to the base taxonomy.
It's really just a clarification question, and I may have just missed this or misunderstood it, but on slide where it says no IFRS taxonomy extensible features, it says staff holds the view that linking instead of taxonomy extensible features best supports IFRS financial reporting. I don't understand what you mean there by instead of taxonomy extensible features.
Can you go
that
back just didn't... to that slide? Sorry.
63,
27. Different numbers, sorry. Yeah. Excellent.
One.
Okay, really, and maybe, but really said we consider when we 2-3 years ago we said okay, we don't think we can create a taxonomy that includes all entity specific disclosures, and we were looking for a solution to handle this entity disclosure. We looked very much at what other regulators had done in that space. We thought the solution that, for instance, the UK FRC had proposed with this further analysis element, that definitely had some attraction to us. Maybe we also really want to say, okay, are there other solutions out there? And that's why we considered, look, we want to bring that. That's why I say instead of, because this would have been an option as well to address some of the problems if we had not come up with a better option of anchoring or...
I understand what you're saying. Thank you.
Over here first.
So I think that I'm not quite convinced by this argument of the size of the taxonomy. Mm-hmm. There are taxonomies which are far, far bigger than IFRS taxonomy. CRD4, not to mention the Solvency II, which is 400 tables and thousands of dimensions. Software vendors have implemented really smart mechanisms and a really good way of handling that. Rendering link base helps there. A number of features of the XBRL standard help there. So this argument, I think, belongs to the previous century, when we were really looking at the taxonomy from the perspective of reflecting the paper version of the bound volume, and we were worried that 4,000 elements is quite a substantial number because people were looking at it manually. I think that we should slightly change this perspective, and this ties to this point on the percentage, I think, on the threshold, 10 or 30%. Frankly speaking, if it is only 1%, but in the context of absolute numbers of, let's say, 1% of 5,500 issuers, which will be under ESMA, or, I don't know, 8 or 9,000 companies under SEC, and it creates, actually covers pretty much the entire industry, these entities from this industry, from this subgroup of 1%, will benefit from a reference model like a detailed disclosure guidance from the IFRS taxonomy. So I'm not very convinced by the argument of either the size or whether this applies to 3 or 5 companies. I think that the threshold could be much, much lower because, simply speaking, that's a reference model. And the more we give those reference models, the less comparability issues and the fewer extensions we'll have.
And you may be right. Yeah, I'm just portraying what I have heard so far. It also seems to be what Lewis has heard. I think the difference with some of the taxonomies you refer to is maybe you have one end user who has set all the data requirements here and has put their database design and all their analysis tool against it. Now, typical for investors, the investors will look at the IFRS taxonomies, yeah, and they have their own data models, which you call, can call proprietary taxonomies. That can be a data aggregator's proprietary taxonomy. That can just be a sell-side analyst model in an Excel spreadsheet, which can be individual or which can be more like a more global
applicable. But I think we are more focusing on proprietary, right?
No. I'm focusing both. So when I'm saying about size of the taxonomy, you have to think both. Again, here, for a preparer, they may find it useful to have additional elements, but then you have to do it in such a way that these elements can be easy found, because otherwise it may not work that very well. From a consumer, you have to have the issue from they have to, I still wouldn't like to use this word anymore, I'm going to use it, they have to map all this data in their proprietary taxonomies and data models.
But let's forget for a second about proprietary taxonomies and data models.
But everyone, that's the key point there.
I know, but if we bother about that, then we will probably end up nowhere, because there will be multiple users using their own different models, and it's their role to map to the reference model. So if the taxonomy of IFRS is considered a reference model, then I, as a user, would be interested in having my whatever model actually tied somehow to this taxonomy, because that's the authoritative one. So let's forget for a second about all the troubles over there. From the preparer's perspective, it's very, very simple. If I have a choice and it's the choice is given to me, then I'll pick one of the choices over there. If I need to figure out on my own what I need to put, then there will be all sorts of ways in which I'll consider to put it in. And we are just basically, you know, pushing this issue of analyzing what did the preparer put in and what it ended up with, either to analysts at the end or to us in the end going forward, without the things listed. So that's why the taxonomies in supervisory space are not allowing that kind of flexibility, or when they are allowing this kind of flexibility, they still give a reference model, which the users can do. If you look, I'm sorry, I'm going to give another example from supervisory space. You've got standardized models for assessing your risk, and then you've got internal rate spacing, ratings-based model. If you don't want to follow internal rating modes, use the standardized. And that's pretty much the role of the IFRS taxonomy. It's the ultimate reference model over there for everyone to use. If they want to really and they need to cater it for their own purposes, they have the rules how to do it. They have the guidance how to do it. They should know how to do it. But this is something that actually fulfills the requirement of the larger base.
Don't see necessary conflict here, because I'm aware of the time. Like, for instance, if this impairment of property, plant, and equipment in Brazil, where it's something entity-specific, if you say to someone, okay, we have now in our taxonomy an element for impairment of property, plant, and equipment, you just say, okay, you have here now this extension, and you link that extension to impairment of property, plant, and equipment. So it doesn't seem to be big. Now, maybe if you wouldn't mind, I would like to continue this discussion a little bit more in detail to make sure I fully understood it.
Yeah. Can I just... I think we can get down into the weeds with this for 1,000 years, and it's ridiculous, to be honest. Let's face it, there's another issue, which is that the team has limited resources. So you're naturally going to resist the idea of adding lots of extension elements until someone solves that problem. So whatever the end result is it's too early to know. I know we feel as though we've been at this for a very long time, but we're just at the very first page of the story of reporting with the IFRS taxonomy. So I'd encourage everybody not to get into any, you know, fixed perspectives about what the right answers are here. Let's get some data and let's understand it. And that's going to take a little while.
Good point. All right, Mike, we're kind of running a bit behind on time, but go ahead.
Mine's a simple question. The slide decks that we just saw, they're not in the shared document folder. So are we going to put those up later?
Should be in slideshare.
Yeah, they're at the tag end of the. They're in there. They're all compiled together.
It was HTML6.
So I'll go by track again. Sorry.
If you have any
questions. User error. Keep moving on.
Okay, calmly.
I'm going to make linking to the basic taxonomy and extension, but I think that the comparability is totally different things. So thinking about common practice is improving, could improve to the comparability. But not always technology can solve this without thinking about what is good disclosure. So I want to continue to do both.
Okay. And that's why I think we, Rachel made at the beginning of the day, it's like, it's this combination, primary financial statements, taxonomy, it's all works together to bring
And one more thing is users, the image, we should change the image of how to use data when we are going to the tagging of financial statement. It's not about single person to pick up to some elements. It's when we can available over the tagging data, in the cases, user side also become more machine. So that the automatically taking data, in the cases, we don't care about how many elements existing. So that maybe we have to change in some kind of the consumer. No, okay, don't.
I have a slightly different view. I think machines facilitate, but I don't think they necessarily replace everything. They can help. I think if I were a user and I see a significant change in impairment from one year to another, and that seems to be unusual within my trend analysis and my model, so it's an outlier, I still would like to look at exactly what is included in that particular element, which I can do by looking to the extension elements. And if that doesn't give me enough information, I may even go back and look at whatever the human readable version of the document is, whether that's PDF, inline, XBRL, or something else, really. So I think it's not our end game. I think it's not say, look, machines are going to read financial statements and make investment analysis. There's a nuance there. But that would be, with that, I would just end my presentation.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we've skipped through our break. We could take a short break now, or we can continue on. I assume folks want to take a short break. So let's take a till 4:30.